It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
They might talk about humor, music, film, books, football, and box sets, exercise, and maybe even food. Trivia and sport, politics and health, sometimes well-being too. On the Life with Brian. On the Life with Brian.
Hello, this is Life with Brian, episode 12. Nice to have you with us. Mark here, joined by our eponymous host, Brian McClare. Are you okay, Brian?
I'm not bad in the circumstances after watching Scotland last night.
And Matthew, who's probably feeling a little bit perkier after England's exploits last night, you're here to keep us all together.
Matthew's not English, he's every other nationality apart from English.
I'm every nationality that play against Scotland and Wales.
Where did you get that from? You stole that idea as well.
I can't disclose such information. But let me be the first one to offer my commiserations, and hopefully it won't be another 23 years before we see you back in a major tournament.
That was almost genuine.
Always.
Yeah. Well, our special guest this time is a real heavyweight of the sports journalism world, and here's hoping we don't drag him down to our level. It's a pleasure to welcome the chief football writer at The Times, Henry Winter. Henry, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. I think more overweight than heavyweight, but thanks for the compliment.
So, Brian, you were at the Scotland-Croatia game, which was a big disappointment for your boys. What sets them and their big players apart from the Scots in these situations?
The Croatian team's got a lot of criticism for their first two games. They probably played for about 20 minutes against the Czech Republic at Hampden last week and managed to get the rest of the game kind of back, which got them a draw. I thought they did okay against England, but last night it was what I liked about the game before the game was the consideration that both teams could qualify. So I thought that the Croatians would have a lot to play for, but the way they played, I mean, and to step up, that Modric scoring a goal, and Perisic is one of the other top players, and one of the things that Alex Ferguson used to go on about with good players was that they were brave, not brave in that they're going to have a fight with people, but brave in that they always want the ball. And every single time that there was an opportunity for Modric to get on the ball, he got it, and he was tackling, you know, not huge slight tackles, but intercepting. And it was great to see that. Now, you're right about the age thing. It is just a number, and I'm glad that somebody like Modric doesn't look at those things as part of it, and indeed the coach of Croatia. He was just, I say, it was a joy to be there. Preparation, lifestyle, the number of games they play, I suppose, as well, how they can get, there's enough rest, and all that must add to the longevity of of certain players. And also, for me, they fell in love with football, didn't they? So they all fell in love with football at a young age. And quite clearly, those players still love it and want it to continue quite rightly as long as possible. And maybe part of that is the understanding that it's more finite now when you get to your mid-30s than it was when they were maybe starting out at 19 and 20.
It was something that came out, I thought, in the Michael Jordan documentary, this ability when you get to a certain age and when you won so much to actually create fights that don't actually exist. And Modric did that with the English in the build-up to the game. He kept on saying, oh, football's coming home, the lack of respect, the commentators, the media, the fans, slightly forgetting that the English voted for him as for the Ballon d'Or that year. And it was almost like he had to sort of create this sort of false narrative of the English patronising Modric when actually he's always been praised. It was something... I don't know whether sort of sportsmen and women do that, actually, just to keep that hunger burning by imagining fights that actually aren't really there.
I think it's a good thing and a healthy thing to do. It was certainly something that happened in all my time with Alex Ferguson. They would always... That's what he created, a thing. And, his idea was that you should have a siege mentality at Manchester United. Just accept that. Outside Manchester United fans, everybody else is going to dislike you, accept that and use that. And then I think that was a big part of the success of Manchester United teams under Alex Ferguson.
He never forgave us for voting for Ginola as Footballer of the Year, I think the year after you left. He kept on mentioning, I voted for Schmeichel that year. It was one of those ones where the Football Writers Association were sort of absolutely divided because Manchester United had so many good players in that treble-winning season. And Ginola crept in. And I just love this about Ferguson. I mean, you obviously know him really well. Whether he actually sort of used that to sort of drive, you know, just as fuel for the fire, or whether he was absolutely genuinely furious that we voted for a Spurs winger that year.
I think there was probably both. Mm. You know, there probably were both things that he would have been furious about that, but also he would always use things that he felt would... become a positive spin, to help win games and go on to win over the long term trophies and titles. The fury part of it, I mean, we've had a few other people on have had experiences of Fergie's hairdryer. It was that sometimes it was he could just turn it on. Depending on the circumstances and what he might want to achieve. He was, I've said all the way through on many, many occasions that he's a wonderful and remains a wonderful pavement psychologist. He had that ability to inspire and also humiliate when it came to certain situations he felt he could gain an advantage for, you know. I mean, he had no problems. I don't know if you've ever... experienced his wrath, Henry, but he had no problems of seeing an opportunity, whether that was right. Well, here's a chance to this person. I've been waiting to see this person, and irrespective of what company he's in or what situation he was in, he's getting it or she's getting it, you know, because he was so focused on the fact that he was going to be right and righteous about what he had to say.
Yeah, I had the hairdryer once and I actually thought, it was such a privilege. I think I put it on my CV and it was completely justified. But I wrote a book with Michael Carrick a couple of years ago. I also ghosted it for him because Michael's so eloquent. He didn't really need much help. But he was talking about that Ferguson would apply this hairdryer and would often ping it to a player he knew was so strong. If he wanted to make a point to everyone in the dressing room halftime, he would ping it to one of the strongest people there, and then all the other players were looking at him and said, well, if he's having a go at Scholes, we've all gigs, we've all got to raise our game. Would you think it was targeted deliberately? He went to, he used it as a weapon as well as the fury.
I think that became more refined as he went through his at the beginning, and I think it was as well, because everybody could get one at half time, or a lot of people could get one at half time, but the starting point of it would be the most important part of it. So whoever he decided to criticise right at the half time would be one who would be making a point to everyone So the point is, I'm having a go at this person. But then he would use that, and then he'd maybe go on to. So that one was the most most forceful one. So for me, I used to, if I had made a mistake before half time, that's the thought that's going to be in the forefront of his mind, what I thought. And I used to kind of pray that somebody else would make another mistake so that I wouldn't be the first one to guess it, you know. So, and it was like, and it's a terrible thing really when you're in a team game and then somebody makes a mistake a few seconds after, a few seconds before half time, and you're actually going, yes, I'm not getting it first. And that was not always guaranteed, you know, because there might be something there that was so, to him, that was so critical of it happened at 2.5, you might still get it, but there was always that kind of wee bit of hope that, oh, well, I'll just wait for mine. And the first part of it would be the most ferocious. But there was for reasons, yeah. So, there was all for reasons.
So did you know, Brian, when you were playing in a game, did you know, could you actually predict when this rollicking was going to happen? I mean, was it that obvious?
Sometimes I was. It was, but having seen him do it, having seen him go from when I was coaching at United, and I wanted them to do something with regards to just have a word with some of my players who had been a little bit naughty. I'd already told them, but I wanted them to. If they were going to survive in football, they needed to be able to survive the manager speaking to them and the way that the manager speaks to them. And I just bumped, and he was walking on the corridor doing what he normally does, singing badly. And I said, look, can you just go and have a word with me? What is it? You know, I says, do you want me to, you know, I give him the full force. And he went from that jaunty, happy smile into that, walked into that room and gave them a hairdryer and walked back out again. And continued to sing and dance up back up the corridor, so he could switch it on brilliantly and be in that right in that moment. So when you look at it, and I was looking back, he spent that period of time working out what he was going to say and who he was going to say it at halftime, and it would appear that he was out of control, but he wasn't. He was in complete control of what he was saying and who he was saying it to, why he was saying it, what he was expecting. He was expecting the outcome to be, but what he would always finish with at the end of the irrespective of where you win, losing, and draw, at the end of that period at halftime, he would always send you back out with a positive. So he'd do all of that, and he would send you back out where, listen, you can still win this game if you keep it going, Melissa, this, and you win. Always a positive at the end of the halftime.
Well, when I started covering Manchester United, I did a deal with the Telegraph because normally they would say, if you cover a match report, we want 2/3 of your match report delivered at half time. And I said, there's some alchemy that happens in the Manchester United dressing room at half time. And Manchester United just come out fired up in the second half. So can I file my main chunk at 60 minutes? Because often that 15 minutes when you lot have come out with a flea in your ear, all that inspirational words from Sir Alex. And often it would define the game. But one thing I've always been fascinated by is that right? A lot of his team talks just before you went out, before the game itself, were often absolutely nothing to do with football. They were to do with shipyards, mining, your family.
As I say, that was part of the pavement psychology about taking things from life and using them to try and inspire his football team. I remember, I tend to read fiction with the occasional kind of non-fiction, but he never read any fiction. Everything he read was non-fiction, mainly autobiographies or biographies. And my whole idea still is, I was trying to escape from real life, not to immerse myself in other people's lives that may have been better or worse than mine. But what he was looking for, I think, were little nuggets of information. So if he was reading, this a lot to do with leaders and politicians, what he was looking for, and there was something he could take out as an example or something he could change from an experience that they may have had in the political world, or maybe even something to do with General Patton, for example, who he really enjoyed reading about leaders and warfare, which he can then use in the battlefield of which he saw as the football pitch. And he would produce little bits and pieces of things like that in there. And they had all these little tricks. And when he's walking in and he's saying to you, and he walks straight in sometimes with the same idea, his team talks were really always half an hour long. And he would, but sometimes he would start off with a different little bit. And sometimes he would come in and go, you should be happy he's playing today, you should be happy he's playing today, you should be happy he's playing today, you should be happy he's playing today. I tell you why, because this is going to be a battle out there. And, you know, and if it turns into a battle, which once or twice I was involved in, you know, he's going to be on your shoulder and he'll be by your shoulder. You know, does it matter what you think about each other? Does it matter what happens? You know, this is what you'll do. You'll be a team. And if you all do what I'm asking you to do today and you do it for each other, you'll win the game. And so that made you feel like, you'd look round often and you'd go, yeah, I'm quite happy he's playing in the team, you know. But, yeah, and it gave you for him to point to you and say, you know, was often inspiring.
Is he one of the great socialists?
Yeah. But, I mean, he believes in the team. You know, his the picture that he's always had in his wall, certainly throughout the time that I was a player there and being involved in there as a coach, is of steel workers building the Empire State Building. And they're having lunch, sitting on a girder several hundred feet above New York. And you could take the background and everything else away, put them at a table, and they were sitting there quite normally eating their sandwiches. And there's 11 of them, and he used to tell people that was his ideal team. That's your ideal team, because every single one of them every time they go up that height, are relying on the guy next to them for his life. For his life, you know. If one of them slipped, the other one would take a risk of himself and grab him and stop him from falling down. So very much about the team.
Yeah, there's another photograph that's come out recently about a picture of the photographer who was taking that picture, and he looked so nervous.
Henry, we've had a lot of esteemed journalists and writers from Fleet Street, whatever you want to call it, on the show, including yourself now, of course. I'm just wondering what your experiences working with Fergie were. I mean, you mentioned you were on the end of a hairdryer now and again, but I mean, how did you find him as a man to deal with?
Remarkable. And it's interesting listening to Brian talking about the hairdryer. And everyone talks about the sort of ferocity and the fury of it. No one actually analyses the words. And I think of all the... And I've been fortunate to interview pretty much everyone in the game. And no one speaks more beautifully than Sir Alex Ferguson. I know he's credited, I think, an English teacher that he had at school. And you almost see, I mean, someone who loves words like me and loves sentences and the mechanics of how they were put together. Sir Alex's sentences, he speaks beautifully. You don't need to tighten up the grammar. The sub clauses are all dropped in perfectly. They're like they're almost lowered into place by a gentle crane. He speaks so beautifully. And I mean, I've been fortunate to interview him sort of two, three times down the years in his office. And in an hour's interview with someone, you would normally get 5,000 words. They always said that JFK was one of the greatest talkers, and he was like sort of six or seven, but he was like sort of almost sort of machine gun when he spoke. Sir Alex was about 5,000 words. And when I went through it, I thought, right, what can I leave out? Probably at the most 400 or 500 words, because it was every word carried resonance. It's just a natural orator. So yeah, I mean, it's just he. I would put him in my top three of people that I've been privileged to interview, because you knew when you came out of that office. I mean, you're partially listening to him, and as Brian says, you know, the steelworker's picture on the wall, the sort of that hanging. I come from govern. The boxer of the latest, you know, most amazing wine sort of half opened, you know, because fascinating man. I mean, just the level of interest. I can remember when Manchester United were going up to Glasgow, I think it was to play Rangers about 15 years ago. And I was in his office beforehand, which was a rare privilege. And I said, oh, it's half term. I think the kids are going to come up as well. And he immediately named three museums to go to. And I think he was a trustee of two of them. I mean, he's just one of the great British, Scottish characters out with football as well as football as well. So, but I remember once a game in, two particular memories. One, I don't know whether Brian will remember this because he came off the bench, but it was in Košice. I think it was in 97, away match. And Košice is quite an interesting place. It's got quite a famous cathedral. And I'm a former choir boy. And so whenever I see a place like that, I love going in, listening to the choirs and hearing what the acoustics are like. But I went around it and I saw Brian was walking around there with Sir Alex. And that sort of always struck me, that interest in life. You know, there's something that Rooney always said. Whenever we talk to Rooney on trips, I would have a sort of, you know, brief chat with him, if you can, on trips. And I would say, well, how do you know about this country? And he said, oh, Sir Alex told me to read this book on this. I mean, Rooney on the Second World War was fascinating because Sir Alex had fired that, you know, interest in that with him. And I look at all the players that I see now coming through at Manchester United and the individuals he shaped. I don't think there's anyone who hasn't been shaped for the better by Sir Alex. And I would say that as a journalist, even slightly from a distance. I mean, there's one anecdote from a game at Valencia-Mestalla. I mean, I'm quite a nosy journalist. I like all journalists. I quite like wandering around where I'm not supposed to be. And I found myself wandering around before the kickoff, about an hour before the kickoff at Mestalla, when Manchester United were playing Valencia. And Sir Alex came out of the dressing room and chomping on Jaffa cakes, which is something I always associated with Brian, actually, an affiliation for Jaffa cakes. I don't know whether that was imagination, but he was chomping on his head. He said, "Hey, who do you think's in my team?" Because we'd always try and, you know, guess what Sir Alex's team would be in the paper in the morning, which was always difficult because he would always throw a curveball in, like leaving Schmeichel out against Barcelona. And I sort of went through the sort of team I thought it would be, and a couple of us did who were there, and we got 9 out of 11. I said, "Well, you know, that's quite good given your tendency to rotate and spring surprises in Europe." And he's 9 out of 11, not good enough. Never try to guess the mind of a madman, and walked off jumping on his jacket. And I just thought, this is, I come from quite a sort of bubble background in the centre of London, and just to meet people of Sir Alex's substance, just, you know, he was just a box of eloquent fireworks, I think. So yeah, privileged to have met him.
When I went to United, it was, I realised how serious he was about things after my first hair dye was in a pre-season game, the very first pre-season in Belfast. And my first thought was that even though Lord had a few of them previously, particularly at Motherwell under Jock Walsh, who was another fierce manager. But this one was just a bit... the game that I remember getting from Jock Walsh were competitive games. This was a pre-season friendly against a League of Ireland select. We'd drawn 0-0 at Windsor Park, and he tore shreds off people, and me in particular, because I had the audacity to swap shirts with one of the guys in the League of Ireland. I never ever swapped a shirt again after that, unless if it was given absolute. Because I got it twice. You know, I got it. Right. Well, I got it with the notes. I didn't have a top on. I tore strips off me, and then I got it again because I at the end of it, I stupidly, another thing I'd learned was, rather than just leave it at that, I put my hand up as if I was in class, and he went back. He came back in. What the fuck is it? And I said, well, do you want me to go and ask for the strip back? And he just turned around staring at me and just went, "You're a fucking idiot." And I just thought, and at that moment in time, I thought, I've made a mistake here. I can't do this. I can't. This is a pre-season game. What's it going to be like when we play Liverpool, you know, or City? But you can see, from that, was you see that how much he cared about it, how much he wanted you to be, even those games he felt were, the performances were important. And he was going to drive you. And I think that's quite evident when you see him in the most recent film, particularly, you know, the Aberdeen's Cup final win against Rangers, where he says that it was only two players that turned up. That kind of hunger, you know. One of the things I used to love when he come in the first day of pre-season and say, forget about last year. Forget about those things you've won. Who's willing to climb back up to the top of the mountain? Because I am. And anybody that wants to come, they can come with me. But if you don't want to come, just come and see me and I'll let you go. And I used to think that was great, you know, that we're back at work again right from the very first day. And he drove you right through in various different ways. Sometimes you would get a bollock in, sometimes you would get a kind word. He knew almost everything about you. And so he was always asking about, you know, how the kids are, everybody, you know, incredible mind he's got, his capacity. Like, and I think that's the stuff that comes through in the film. But his greatest fear was losing his memory, because some of this stuff that he could come out with was incredible, you know, particularly about football teams that played in cup finals, both in Scotland and in England. He drove that kind of thing every day. So every day his demands were the highest you could be. McClare's on mark!
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
I was reading about Spain the other day and how they've got a psychologist who's involved in their backroom staff, just someone who's there not to push themselves forward with regards to their perception of what they see with players and the staff and the manager, but to be there to give them some guidance. And I think all those things are a very positive step in the right direction.
Do you think this is why you're so good at player development? I mean, obviously we're seeing the sort of the blossoming of a lot of your work, you know, McTominay and players like that. But do you think that they have sort of flourished because of you have this emotional empathy?
Yeah, but then it's not just me. That's Alex Ferguson's work, because he chose all those people that were involved in the football development part of it. At one point of it, I was nominally in charge of it, but there was a great team of people there who understood how children worked, who understood what they needed and when they needed it. And then the main thing in particular is about being patient. So if you look at the team, the Scotland team, for example, last night, and you've got Andy Robertson. Andy Robertson was released as a 14-year-old. And from what I can recall, he was told that he was going to be too small to be a football player. So if you apply the same idea to Jesse Lingard, for example, he would be Manchester United would have different periods right through when the times came to decide him on the next contract throughout the academy system, 10, 12, 14, 16. With regards to physicality, Jesse Lingard wouldn't have kept them. Scott McTominay was very similar, but he had the other problem. He had Michael Keane was another one of the other problem. They were fast growers, they were going to be big people. They needed patience to allow themselves to grow into their frame. And you would watch games that Scott McTominay and Michael playing, where you would be almost, you were feeling so much for them because they couldn't perform because her body wouldn't allow them. They had all the other attributes you knew that, given time, that, that hopefully that would come out. And I think that that's always been something that we were allowed to do. Alex Ferguson never put you under any pressure. He wanted to know what the player was like as a person, as a character. The physical part of it, he could say himself. He always would always ask the question about how tall is the mother, because nearly every boy is goes to be taller than your mother. Just a fact of human life, but the character was more important. But we felt that, you know, we'd rather keep players. Tom Cleverley was another one who went through a difficult time. You know, Tom Cleverley didn't get a contract at 16, but we encouraged him to stay at school and keep working away. So there's always different kind of ways of going through it. Marcus was always one that was all you could see all the way through the age groups, which could potentially be a good player, but just needed that opportunity to show what they can do. So I think that for me, for youth development, football was always about being patient and giving them as much time as you possibly could. And I think that that's been of great benefit to Manchester United and also the national teams that those players have represented. And then for them, you've got to be biased, and I can't really say that much about an awful lot of other development places and development situations within football, but I think you've seen an awful lot more would be quicker to make judgments, mainly based on the physical attributes or lack of physical attributes, if you're talking about Scott McTominay and Michael Keane, who were quite weak, even though they were 6 foot odd, only because they needed to get that bit more time to get the strength in the body.
You showed every bit of patience, you and Sir Alex, for Ravel Morrison, probably the most gifted footballer I've seen for, just remarkable player. What are there some players that, however much patience and love you show, they're just things in their mind, in their background, in their character that you can't overcome?
Yeah, but all players have got to. I never made anybody a player. Alex Ferguson has not made anybody a player. You make yourself a player. You know, you made yourself into a journalist if that was your aspiration from the moment you stepped into school. You worked really, really hard at it, and you were dedicated to it. You did apprenticeships in different places. You listened to other people. You admired other people. You took all that stuff and learned and got to a situation where you're now working for the world's probably most renowned newspaper. That didn't happen overnight. You know, you put the graft in, and there's always going to be certain situations with certain people that you can only do so much for. I mean, Warren Joyce, when Ravel got he had to go and paint some fences because he had been in court and he'd been in the wrong place the wrong time, and supported him all the way through that. He could have potentially got a custodial sentence. He didn't, and he was sent out to paint fences and muck out in some stables at times. And Warren Joyce went along and actually helped them, you know, made sure he was complying with the probation rules. So Warren went along with him and actually ended up painting fences and mucking out stables. Now, that's a nobody kind of knows those kind of things about how far you go for people. We got all sorts of different people involved. But at the end of it, it comes down to whether the player wants that or not. But within that, you're talking about with our success in certain players, your major success is a player playing for Manchester United's first team. Your bottom line of it is, a tragic situation where they're not playing at all, or in some circumstances, you know, even worse, you, for example, then ending up in prison and not playing football ever again. I would look at Ravel as a success because he's still playing football.
You consider him a success, but he hasn't fulfilled his talent.
He's playing football, you know. Part of it's not all about talent, you know. It's not, and the talent part of it is as well, though, I don't believe in necessarily believe in talent. I think there's genetics involved in practice. Ravel practiced his 10,000 hours before anybody else because he didn't go to school, you know. And then when he played, when he was playing and all the way through, so you tend to have in academy football, that's all you have is academy football. We would allow them to play for school if they wanted to also. We got that balance between the travel, between the coaching hours, between the playing hours, and also getting rest all the way through your formative years. Ravel was out playing football or doing some kind of physical activity all the time. You know, he would go with his friends and play in the park. He would go where he wasn't supposed to be going, to the pits in Manchester, and playing with his mates, sometimes in goal, sometimes out. He was practicing more than anybody else. So the time he gets to the thing where you can see what he can do, said yes, I would say I'll talk my cap to genetics because of his speed and his balance and his brain, is the mental side of it, with regards to playing football. But ultimately, he didn't have the discipline in order to be a Manchester United player under Alex Ferguson. And I would say that he's successful in that. You know, if you look at the top level, whether it's, you know, he should have been playing at Manchester United, for indeed England, and starting to, he could have been in prison. That's how I look at it. So the fact that he's in the, whatever you want to say on that scale, he's earning a living in football, and he's far as I know, he's behaving himself. So yeah, I would say that was success.
Did your job in youth development become more difficult as time went on in terms of motivating effectively kids who are 18 who could almost be millionaires?
Yeah, well, I didn't do that. I wasn't part of that. So unless they were involved in the first team, my attitude was that they should get paid according to the. It was a bit easier for me in that I had the full backing of Alex Ferguson and of course David Gill. David Gill was setting the policy, and we didn't have a policy of paying hugely for players, particularly salary wise. If they got into, as soon as they left and they were under the first team's umbrella, whatever David and Sir Alex decided they should get paid was entirely up to them. I felt that they should have, and that was, everybody always get paid different, that's never going to change. But I try to keep it as low as possible, because all the way through there's too many distractions. And then you're fighting against distractions all the time. So I suppose as you go travel along, there are increasing number amount of distractions. And that's why I always insisted, or we always insisted, that we had black boots, not because I was trying to be difficult about it. And indeed, it did cause problems in a way, because for younger players, the black boot, because it became a rarity, was actually more expensive than any other different coloured boots. Although then we were fortunate enough, the club decided they would supply footwear to all the kids in the academy. But then when they become a little bit older and they get little bits of contracts with manufacturers who want them to wear their product even at that level, because that's what they want the public to buy. But we just felt it was a distraction. And poor Michael Keane, when he was with the England under-21s, the rest of the players were calling him. Do you know what they were calling him?
Was it the referee or something?
The referee, yeah, because he was wearing black boots. So I had a bit of sympathy, but we'll do it for the right reasons, because they'd get up, get in the mock. I mean, Chris Eagles is a great example of that as a younger player. Chris Eagles, as a 16-year-old, has something like 30 pairs of boots in his room. Every different imaginable colour and style of, I think he was with Nike, in his room, you know. So he's getting up, he's confused enough anyway, Chris, without having the choice of what colour of boots he's going to wear. So take that away, you know. You're not allowed to wear hats and gloves. You're not allowed to wear underarm. You're not allowed to wear any leggings. You know, get out. You don't wear that when you're playing, unless you can get a note from the doctor to say that you need to wear gloves. It's just all distractions. That's what it was about, keeping them away from distractions. Not to be cruel. Like, just go on, put those boots on, get out to work. You're coming to work. This is work, you know? This is what serious fun, but it's work.
Yeah, how do you deal with social media then? Because kids like expressing themselves, they put all their whole lives out there, and obviously, you know, footballers, young footballers can use it, as Marcus has done brilliantly, for changing society. But does it inhibit, does it damage, does it harm the young players?
I think they're in a realm now where it clearly there is a danger to people, I think, with social media, not just... you've got over 1 million followers on Twitter. How do you... you can't satisfy them. How do you enter into a conversation on a particular subject with 1 million followers?
Well, I do, because I quite enjoy it, because actually I use it as a sort of... as a resource. Because if I'm going to a Manchester United match, I'll tweet a picture of Old Trafford from the outside of the ground, and then I will get... you know, maybe sort of 50 really intelligent comments about, oh, so-and-so's playing well, have a look at this new kid who's on the bench. It's a remark for a journalist.
Yeah, you know, so it's a research too. Yeah.
It's a complete research. So I've only kept one tweet from a fan who said, listen, mate, I only keep following you to see what shite you come up with next. and I think that, particularly if you've got a bigger ego like me, I think it's actually quite so humbling. It's very useful. But just coming back to the players, and I've seen some of the... you know, the abuse that Marcus got on social media. I mean, this is a young man who's gone out and saved lives in this country during the pandemic. And then the racist abuse. I mean, I think he posted that he got sort of 70 offensive messages, racist messages. There were more than 700. And they were absolutely full. And there were voice messages in there, a lot obviously on Instagram. You know, so how do you, as someone who has been... in that world, how do you look after, or how do you help these?
It's just about education and pointing out these things. I mean, one of the dangers I see about social media is how it's used with regards to commercial activity. Mm. That's how I sometimes see why there's, you know, so if you've got a lot of followers, I would have looked that nowadays it's people will be interested in tagging on some kind of product that you might be willing to support. So I think there's that aspect about it. But I don't understand why they do that, because they're getting paid for me well enough by their football club or by just their main sponsor, which is usually a sportswear manufacturer, so it's nearly always Nike or Adidas or Puma, and I think they get paid well enough for that. So I don't really see something, and they should be able to satisfy their ego by playing football in front of 70,000-80,000 people.
But they make.
So I find that difficult.
Sorry, interrupting you, brother. They make millions through social media. And if you are sort of Mesut Ozil, who's got this huge global following, when his agent goes in and talks to, you know, the his Turkish employers, there will be an element in the contract of we want two tweets from you a week talking about whether something to do with the, you know, the commercial side of the club or something to do with some ticketing or community enterprise. The more and more, well, you know, it's about more and more players are actually the social. They've monetized social media far quicker than anyone else.
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying. It's part of the education that all you can do is educate them in the good and bad of social media. And I don't know if it was absolutely right or not, but I was told that once that Manchester City adopted all their first team squads Twitter accounts. And they were in control of what tweets were being sent out.
I'll be surprised. Players are quite protective about their account.
I know Dempsey's saying that sort of thing. I can see that they're looking at what we control. You just have to be there to support them and help them through different situations with regards to social media. Education is the only way, isn't it? Really, for all sorts of scenarios. Mm. You can't stop people doing it, as you say, particularly if there's a... And then I think you made a particularly pertinent comment there about the number of people that are earning money from football players. So you may well have more than just... I mean, they have more than just an agent now, don't they? They have a whole raft of people who they employ. If they can earn money through and gain money through social media, they're going to actively encourage people to be involved in it.
Well, where are you on footage being shown from the dressing room? Because I always think the dressing room, I'm fascinated by it as a fan, but I think it should be a protected place.
Well, I mean, I love music and all that, so I would love to be able to see what went on in dressing rooms before gigs, you know, when musicians were going, what happened with that and any other dressing room. And I think one of the first ones was, that were allowing that were maybe the rugby league, maybe they would, or even rugby union, maybe and maybe the internationals where cameras were in the dressing room. There was a camera in the dressing room. I'm not saying there's a person in the dressing room, but there was a camera in the dressing room to really show you what's happening. And like you said, those particular moments could be more entertaining than the actual spectacle of the sport. If you have incidences that occur, you know, if you've got people shouting and screaming at each other, or every now and again, there maybe will be a bit of physical activity. I wouldn't have enjoyed that at all, because I think that it should, in my view, is it's something that's too important, you know. And I think that's why there's such an interest, and that's why people would say we have to do this, you know. So you're now in situations where potentially beneficial to yourself, where you're given access because it's part of the Premier League contract or part of the Champions League contract, which players have to appear in front of the media at particular various different moments. Dressing rooms, I wouldn't have liked it, you know, either as a player or as a coach. I think it changes the dynamic of what you're doing, you know. There's when Alex is coming in, he's doing what he's trying to do to for you to play better in the second half, and he decides whatever way that method that's going to be. I think that if you've got that in there, there's just got to be something, a little thought, certainly would be for me, well, what am I going to say, you know? Am I going to get a row from my mother for swearing, you know? Am I going to, you know, the kid's going to be embarrassed about this, is your dad behaving in this sort of way in his work environment? Do you temper that? And therefore, if you're tempering it, are you changing the way you're managing your coaching? Are you going to be less effective? How are the players going to be? Are they behave? How do they behave? You may well, maybe an advantage of you could, because there's several times that you would certainly I would have been, would be, if I was behind Alex Ferguson, I'd be trying to make somebody laugh, you know, who was getting, you know, a bit of a row, you know. So maybe I'd do that, because he'd be able to look at the footage later on. I'd be getting hauled in later on for a telling off, you know, for saying that I'm trying to be fucking serious here and you're fucking laughing, you know.
You said before, Brian, you're involved in that famous Captain's Log series in 94. Yeah. I mean, you said that Fergie very much had editorial control over that for that very reason.
But you recognised, though, being part of it, you learned what you were, mostly what you were going to get away with. He gave his blessing to it, but there, no way that was going out until he had seen and he had editorial control over it. Because, and he would tell you, you know, turn that fucking camera off at various different points. And there's probably loads of stuff lying around on a cutting room floor.
Oh, can you imagine?
Probably more interest.
Yeah, can you imagine the outtakes of that?
More interesting than because I was doing most of the camera work, you know. That's why I don't feature so much in it, you know. But because I'm just wandering around, you know, like things on the bus and all that, you know, playing cards. But you know, the manager throwing cards at people because he's so competitive at everything, you know. You wouldn't want to really have as an example of what occurs, but yeah, I can see it now being a.
But it's just
there's no mystery. I think there should be a mystery to some things. Yeah. So some things you should always think, I wonder what it's like in there, you know.
But that's what made it so fascinating from a fan's point of view to see that when it came out. You know, it was gold dust because we'd never seen anything like that before. And I mean, now it's kind of, we see it quite regularly with Netflix series and behind the scenes documentaries. You know, I think young kids that watch football now are a little bit more au fait with what happens behind the scenes. But back then, none of us were.
I think the problem that I see with all flying the world stuff is that the people who are participating don't actually have a sight of, or can't really get a sight of how they're going to get portrayed You know, when I was doing this stuff, there was bits and pieces that I knew even myself that wouldn't be in it, shouldn't be in it. So we had all that control. When you're looking at all this other stuff now, I think it's embarrassing. I can't watch a lot of it because I think it's cringeworthy, because they're trying to make entertainment out of this, and a lot of the way to do with entertainment, from what I can see, is through people's pain and suffering and discomfort. You don't see them, loads of sort of greats, the stuff, all the good stuff that's happening, because that seems to be what we crave as a viewing public. And why they agree to it, no, I'm not quite sure, you know. And I do think it changes how the coach particularly would behave in the dressing room. I think maybe part of it as well is, if it's talking about City, I think Guardiola would allow them to do a certain bit and then cameras off, where he's going to do the same sort of thing with regards to be critical of his players or be a bit harsher with his players, because I think all great coaches have a mix of how they deal with players individually and collectively, and that's probably the most critical part of a game of football with regards to your opportunity to affect change. You see coaches shouting at the touchline, you see them remonstrating, you see them sitting doing nothing or whatever, because a lot of the times the players either, even if they could hear them, don't listen or appear not to be listening. And that 15 minutes is probably, they say, the most important part of a match.
Well, and I realised the importance of Manchester United when they made the film Beyond the Promised Land just after the treble, and they came down to sort of interview me at Trafford Park Printers, where the Telegraph, where I was at the time, had an office. And they said, well, we really want to show you as a journalist. Can you put sort of like a pork pie hat on? I said, well, I'm not doing that. They said, well, could you do the interview? Can we do the interview down actually in the print site with the printing presses rolling in the background? It was sort of old school, and the sort of, you know, the papers flying everywhere and the printers stacking everything up. And I said, well, of course, but it will be quite noisy. And they said, no problem. So this film crew came down and they stood me in front of the printer just to talk about what amazing night in Barcelona it had been. And they said, well, it is a bit noisy there. Can you just turn off the print site? And I said, seriously, to turn off a print site, I mean, it costs tens of thousands of pounds a minute. And I probably don't know whether I should be saying this, but I think one of the guys down there was a massive, oh, they were massive Manchester United fans. And he said, no problem, flicked a switch and they all stopped. I was worried that there'd be sort of half of Cheshire the next day when they've got the first edition of the Telegraph.
Just saying that about again sort of stereotypical stuff that from the little bits I've read, that, and correct me if I'm wrong, and it was that one of the reasons that you were so keen to go to the Times was to follow Geoffrey Green.
Yeah, I mean, he was, you know, when I was a kid, 12, 13, growing up, I mean, I just loved the idea of travelling the world, writing and watching football. It just didn't seem like a proper job. I mean, all the guys in my class just have gone off and done amazing, amazing things, tops of their profession in music, politics, advertising, medical things. And now, so, you know, when I meet up with them, they said, well, you know, what's it like going to Azerbaijan? And I mean, I'm very curious about different countries. And I was fortunate to go to school in Munich and Paris, as well as London. And my kids, you know, they've gone to sort of school overseas, and then to have 4 years up at Edinburgh. And Edinburgh, although I'm English through and through, I think, is it Stockbridge you live? I read an interview around there. I mean, that whole area. I mean, Edinburgh, I don't think Edinburgh is a place that ever leaves you. And I don't think Scotland will ever leave me. And the 4 years that I had up there playing in the East of Scotland League, got, you know, going to places like, you know, obviously nowhere near even, not even in the foothills of the sort of, you know, the Himalayas that you've achieved. But just going to these places like Coquitlam Albert and Gala Fairy Dean, I think about them every day, actually. And I'm not a particularly emotional person, but I just think about that experience in Scotland. And particularly with the sort of, you know, my kids' generation are now going through university. And Scotland never leaves you. And to have friends who, you know, Scottish footballing friends is something that I'll treasure for life. And that opportunity to go back up there, go back to the university, their 125th anniversary of the football club. They used to have this thing called they used to have obviously all the Burns night. They used to have a Tommy Burns night.
I was at the first one.
Were you? I mean, what, at the Edinburgh? Because you were Glasgow, weren't you?
Yeah, but I was at Celtic at the time. I was at the very... I've never been to a Burns supper. I've only ever been to a Tommy Burns supper.
Yeah. It's, I mean, they were just amazing, amazing events. And just to sort of experience, even sort of, you know, from a couple of steps back, the power of Scottish football and the power of the you know, there's a magazine up north of the border called Nutmeg. I think they've
been... Yeah, I've done a couple of things,
Honestly, and just I turn a page after page and I just think this is war Scotland for me, just that football. And I remember being fortunate to write a couple of books with Sir Kenny Dalglish, and the first one, the publisher, just after he won the title at Blackburn, and the publisher said to me, he said, well, we need a big name to do the foreword. And Kenny said, Alec, he was called Sir Alex Ferguson, Alec said, well, he'll do it. And I said, well, how's it? There's a chapter on your two, you know, your feud between each other. He said, no, Alec's as good as gold, he'll do it. So I rang up, he was at the Cliff at the time, and I rang up and his secretary said, he'll ring you, he'll agree to do it, he'll write the foreword, you've got three questions, and he'll call you early tomorrow morning. 7 o'clock, phone went, and it's Sir Alex. And he said, right, three questions, I got training. I think it's probably about 3 hours until the players come in for training. But anyway, three questions. I said, right, what's Kenny Dalglish like as a player? And you know what he's like. We've talked about his eloquence. He spoke so beautifully about how Kenny played the ball. And it was lovely, but it was about a sort of 50-second answer, 200 words, beautiful. I was going, this is going so well. He said, right, what's your next question? I said, what's Kenny Dalglish like as a manager? And he said, well, listen, he's won the title at two clubs. You've got to respect that. I always found it a duel and a battle playing against his team, tactically, physically. And again, another 200 words, 50 seconds. I thought, this is just going so well. And then he said, right, what's your last question? I've got training. And I said, well, you know Kenny, what's he like as a person? And he said, he flipped a question back on me. He said, well, you spent time with him doing this book. What do you think? And I said, well, he's got a close unit of his family and of Hanson and one or two other people. But Mr. Ferguson, he doesn't have that huge, well, I perceive that huge collection of sort of friends and associates that you do. And Ferguson went, you only need four people to carry your coffin. Put the phone down. And I mean, it was 7:05 in the morning. And I was thinking, I will never have a more productive 5 minutes. You know, Sir Alex's, Mr. Ferguson at the time's eloquence, his just ability to put things in. And I think, you know, I'm just a sort of, you know, a journalist with an overworked pencil and notepad taking down these notes. And I was thinking, what that must do to the players to actually have that sort of power and eloquence of delivery. So, yeah, that was just, yeah, that affinity towards Scotland, I think, and a taste for whiskey, I don't think will ever leave me.
Just a little aside about Kenny Dalglish, a friend of mine was doing a commercial activity that involved a video and audio of this is now known as Sir Kenny Dalglish. And then when they sent it to the gaffers, he got a message back saying, he sounds a bit Scottish. Can you do something about that?
Naming no names, Brian. Eh?
Sounds too Scottish.
Yeah, I had great fun trying to tell the video editing team to try and make it
sound Scottish. You don't need to out
yourself. Wow.
But Brian, why is that? Why does Scotland keep producing these great footballing minds? Is it, do you sort of all sort of grow up around the kitchen table arguing about the Lisbon Lions and tactics and formation?
Yeah, I can't really say so much about it now, but certainly when I was growing up, I fell in love with football because of the Lisbon Lions when I was a five-year-old boy. I think I was five-year-old, and I saw the black and white cine film on stage at primary school. So I'd always been kicking a ball about, and I enjoyed kicking the ball about. But when I saw that actually was a moment that I fell in love with football, and I thought I'm going to do that, and becoming this overwhelming desire to achieve that. I think a lot to do with the Scots is to do with the, you're brought up to and encouraged to work hard and do your very best at everything you can do, you know. So even although that my parents could see that I was doing quite well at football. They still kept on to me and on to me about education, education, education. Mm-hmm. Football, okay, football, but it could go awry at any moment. You know, it was about working hard, everything that you did. And I could see that those attributes in a lot of those great Scottish managers. It was about how hard they worked. I mean, you just mentioned it there that Alex Ferguson was always in first, and he had been nice to be in his office often. I mean, the phone was ringing like you talk about all the so your situation getting 5 minutes. There'd be loads and loads of people phoning for various different reasons. They would always answer the phone. Sometimes it'd take me, if I'm trying to get a bit of advice from him or an answer from him with regards to my activities at the football club, it sometimes took me an hour to get an answer. He never told me to leave either, which I thought was a sign of faith and trust. You know what I mean? He's maybe had that conversation with you. He's having a conversation with David Gill about potential signings. He's having the conversations with other managers about what they should do. He said all sorts of different people. And at no point did he say to me, get out, you know. I just quite often I was like, I'll come. And sometimes I'd say, I'll come back later. I'd be there for an hour.
It begs the question what you were doing in there so often.
Sometimes I was getting a bollocking.
But Brian, it's
always sometimes I was.
Sorry, but it always seemed to me that with the Scottish players and managers I've met, that there's so much hinterland to them. So they're not one-dimensional. It's not purely about football. So I talk to Pat. Whenever I talk to Pat Nevin, you know, we spend 55 minutes talking about music and then 5 minutes talking about football. You know, Darren Fletcher, you can talk to him about so many. When obviously, you know, Darren, you sort of helped to develop him. I mean, there just seems to be, is it something in the Scottish footballing psyche that actually you're not simply a footballer, but you draw from all your other interests?
I think that part of that is the always encouraged, you always are, whether you want to or not. There's always other interests. There's an always appreciation for other things. I think football and music in Scotland are massive things. And particularly if I just think they've always gone kind of hand in hand, and there's a kind of, often when I spend some time with musicians, they want to be football players.
Yeah.
A lot of football players want to be musicians, and there's a great appreciation of both of each other. That can't contain a particular moment that I fell in love with music, but it's always been part of my life, a huge part of my life. And the same thing about finding other ways to do things. I mean, I think that a lot of the people you're talking about there, even though they might not be have the bit of paper to say that they're academic, but they do have several other interests with regards to what they do away from football. And I think you're always kind of encouraged to have some kind of other interest as well. That you can't. It's not just healthy to be doing just one thing.
Souness has always been very interesting on this. He's always talked about that sort of inquisitive nature of the Scottish mind. And one of the reasons why, I think he always lists very proudly, five of the 10 world's most important inventions, like penicillin, tarmac, I think the phone and the Alexander Graham Bell, isn't it? I mean, five of the most important 10 inventions in the world emanated from the 5 million Scots. So you do have that natural curiosity, which I assume then makes good football managers and good football players as well, because you are pushing back the boundaries.
Yeah, I think that's... I mean, Alex Ferguson used to have a list of 30, so it always up. He used to do it all the time, and what used to astonish me was he'd do it with the players or the staff as well, several of them in English, and none of them were... I don't know what it was, none of them were able to come up with one English person. None of them, not one of them ever said, William Shakespeare. Not one of them ever came out with anything just like, radio. Oh, no, that, oh, no, television. Pneumatic tyre. Oh, no, and there would always be...
Golf.
football, of course, all sports, cricket, golf.
I think we can claim football, actually, but, yeah.
But then I used to use that as part of my fun as well. So I used to, when I'm spending my time amusing myself and my teammates, doing the same sort of thing when round about times of international games about what have England ever achieved, you know, what have they ever met, what they ever invented, what have they done, and all that kind of thing. Haven't have a wee bit of information about it. And I used to be pretty cruel to my teammates. I go, I tell you what, there's an invention, you know, a Scotsman. If they discovered something that was really, really important in your life, really important in your life, you know, and I would say Alexander Graham Fleming, they go, that was all about. He discovered penicillin, and penicillin saved your life.
Yeah.
And he'd be like, how's that saved my life? I say, it's because when you had the clap,
I think it's just as well we don't have a camera in the first room.
So that was my kind of way of, you know, yeah. It seemed like you had that venereal disease that your partner didn't know about. That's what they gave you to clear it all up. And so sometimes they would go, how did you know about that?
Talking of access that we were earlier on, I was interested to know about your two sort of working relationship. I think this is a question you've got, Mark, isn't it, about Henry working with Brian?
Yeah, you're the third journalist and broadcaster we've had on the show so far, and nobody's had a bad word to say about Brian yet. We leave that to his former teammates. Are you prepared to book that trend and dish the dirt, or has your working relationship with him always been good?
I don't think I ever had a sort of sit down one-on-one with Brian. I just
not famous enough.
You were totally famous. I wasn't famous enough.
Not good enough. Not famous enough.
So I just think that I always look at footballers and I think he'd make a good book. And I think of, you know, Brian will probably make two or three good books because there's so much hinterland to him. I do feel a sort of slight, even a greater affinity because of our similar ages, because you were at Glasgow Uni. And I always had this dream that we might have crossed paths on a pitch, but you were far too good. I don't think you were too good to play for Glasgow.
Wasn't allowed.
You weren't allowed, exactly. Yeah. I mean, that was...
Yeah, they did want me to play, but I wasn't... It was quite funny, actually, because the coach of the Glasgow team was the son of the assistant manager, both at Motherwell and Celtic, so it would have been a bit difficult for me. He would have got killed. His dad would have killed him if they found out that I was, you know, even if he was even attempting to get me to play, you know.
Do you know what? It was just such a, you know, just on a personal level, I was the only English person in the football club. There were 81 of them. I was the only public school person in there. And I remember going up for the trials, and I was determined to get into the university team. And I turned up from sort of my rather sort of posh school in London, and the strip that we had, and Brian, you'll laugh, was pink. And so there were all these sort of kids there from all over Scotland, from Ireland, who were sort of turning up in sort of Aberdeen strips and whatever. And I turned up in this sort of pink silk kit, black silk shorts, pink cotton top, nice white cuffs. And honestly, the abuse I got, you know, is your butt not going to take corners? And all that, you know, can the chauffeur drive the team coach and all that? And I got that for about sort of 3-4 months, and then when I finally got a few scars and got accepted, that was, I have to say, was one of the proudest moments in my life.
I think that if I'd been the coach of that team, I would have looked at it and I thought, he's got to be playing, you've got to pick him because he's got some balls, by the way, to be he's got huge balls, we've got to have him in the team.
I had my 21st in Edinburgh, and I had all my sort of English friends and Scottish friends from university, and I invited everyone from the for every 80 of the players in the football club, and a couple of them did come up to me in the shower after one game at Hoy Gala or wherever.
Did you make your way stop that moment? That could be too personal. This question, did they come up to you in the shower? did they approach from the front or from the rear?
It was an ambush. It was the full banner. And they said, they couldn't cope with the name Henry, so they called me Hendo. Everyone called me Hendo. They said, "Big Hendo, what the fuck's black tie?" You know what? They were the first ones. They were Preston Field House on the edge of town, and they were the first ones there, and they were the last ones to leave at 4 o'clock in the morning. And whenever I think of Edinburgh and Scotland and hearing a voice you know, I just think just what a privilege it was just to have been up in Scotland. And just on a technical level, the build-up towards the England-Scotland game, all the England fans, and I heard one or two radio pundits saying, we really, you know, let's hope Scotland get knocked out after the England game, hope they lose. I never, ever, ever feel that. I'm so passionate about England. I never consider myself British. I consider myself English. But my affection and respect and love for sort of Scottish football and for Scottish footballers and the privilege of part of my job to have spent time with Scottish footballers is something I'll take with me to my dying day.
Something you clearly don't agree with, Brian, after speaking to you the other week in Glasgow.
What?
Your affiliation with the English football
team. Nothing to do with English football team in particular. I just like England getting beat at everything.
Yeah.
It's not
fair enough.
It's nothing to do with football. I enjoy all sports. I love cricket, and I especially like it more when England get a beat or struggling, and almost when they then draw or lose. It's just, it's not. It's just, and is it the situation in that is because it's to do with the way that things are sort of reported.
Arrogance is the word you're looking for, Brian.
I'm not sure it is, but I don't see it. For me, it's not the north of England, it's the south of England where you're from. I'm not saying you're arrogant, but I mean, I think that's where it's generated from, more generated from. You lived in England longer than I've lived there, and you went to school in London and that kind of thing. But I always got the feeling that there is a divide, even amongst the media, I suppose, in the time that I was playing, more mainly the written press, there was a northern part of it versus the southern part of it, you know, and there was a real determination between, or a real battle between those two to get the main story and whatever the media outlet that you were involved in at the time. So it's part of that. That's part of it, and it kind of spills over, isn't it? We're going to win. I think that's maybe why there's lots of other. If you're saying that about the Croatians, it's certainly probably something that's perceived. You know, after the World Cup, what did Pogba do? When he's got the World Cup in his hands, and he says, "It's coming home." Oh no, it's not.
Yeah.
So yeah, sometimes I suppose if you can get some people that generate this sort of stuff, you could see how other people see and perceive. I suppose, but that's it's because I'm Scottish and I lived in England, you know, and I'm fighting for a way of annoying my teammates as well. So if they're wanting England to win, I'm because I'm contrary anyway, and I'm looking for to say, always wanted to entertain myself because they didn't entertain me enough, you know, and I wanted to have a laugh and a joke every day, and a lot of times I had to generate myself, and if that meant just taking up the opposite point of view just so that I could be entertained, I would do that. And you know, you just have to accept that in the other way you're going to sometimes come a cropper if your country perform poorly. But that's just the way it is, you know. So
Brian, I believe in Scottish independence. Do you?
I don't actually, no.
Right. What, for economic reasons?
Yeah, not for me. I mean, I don't think that... I feel very, very sad for the generations that are coming up who are now... I mean, we paid for the... We are a generation, just not that long ago, finished paying for the debt from the Second World War. I can't imagine what the debt's going to be like for the things that have happened over the last few months, you know. I think, mainly for the future of young people. I mean, I get to say that maybe it should be young people who should decide what the future of their country is going to be, and that they should, rather than, I mean, in Scotland lowered the age of voting on particular subjects like that to 16, which I think are great. Maybe at the other end they should be chopping it off, which is a bit of contentious issue when I mentioned that to some friends about, not just about independence, but I certainly had that debate with several of my mates in England that who are we to decide about what's going to be, you know, for example.
But you can do that anyway. I mean, I've always voted, certainly for the last sort of decade, I've always voted for my kids. I've said, who do you want to vote for?
Yeah, well, that's how I would vote, yeah. That's how I would always vote, yeah. But it's going to be hopefully beneficial for... But people don't do that, do they? Not many enlightened... I don't think there's that many enlightened people, really. I think it's a lot... I mean, if you just talk about, like, short-term things and selfishnesses, which I think maybe we've become more and more of, for various different reasons, and sometimes forgetful. You know, we've gone through a time that we could never imagine. You know, that growing up, their generation, baby boomer generations. You know, our parents went through tough times. Our grandparents went through the war and the years after the war. And then you get to a situation where we're given guidance about various different things. I know that there was fewer people at the game last night, but I am the only person anywhere around about me that applied the guidance with regards to wearing the face covering. So I don't like it, despite the fact that I've always wanted to look like a bandit when I was playing Cowboys and Indians when I was a kid. I don't particularly like having my face and my mouth covered, but I thought that if that's the guidance, that's what you should be doing. Not for me, because not for me, is it? You know, it's for in general, but there was nobody else around about me had a face covering on.
No. But you know what? That generation, if you're talking about the younger generation, they're the ones who've actually suffered most and probably been least at risk.
Yeah, and that's exactly. I mean, maybe we'll be kicking ourselves for putting them through all that, because you, as you've mentioned before, you went to good school, were well educated, listened, we were diligent and open minded. We were there. I was at Comprehensive School, but the Comprehensive School I was wonderful, great school, great teachers, inspiring teachers, and I got a lot out of that. It gave me the opportunity to not only become a reasonable athlete, but also the qualifications to go to university. And to miss bits of that, I mean, I was always desperate to go to school because I didn't want to miss anything. Didn't want to miss a day because I always felt that I was going to miss something, you know. For them to miss the swathes of stuff that they've missed, we just don't know how that's going to... I know it's going to be difficult for various different reasons, but I think that children should be afforded some kind of leeway, whether that's saying, well, repeat the year, you know, look at the I think it's probably highlighted as well, so the anomalies with regards to how they actually are given qualifications and how they achieve that. I just think that ongoing assessment would always give you a better idea of where you are. And that's how I apply things to football. You're not going to tell a player that he's going to get a contract or not based on the last three weeks of the season. Yet we're doing that with young people, with regards how they fare in exams. Some people are just not equipped for exams. You know, just not. You know? So, but it doesn't mean that in these are situations that moment, those periods of time, and that period of time we come up to your most important exams of your life, define what you're possibly going to do for the rest of your life, or the opportunities that are open for you to do for the rest of your life.
What's up for you next, Brian?
I don't have any particular plans. I'm just enjoying life, which I like I like being able to choose to do what I want to do. I've been in a great position in my hobby, never call it work because it's a hobby, whether that's playing or coaching, to have kind of stability with regards to my line managers, who were Alex Ferguson and David Gill. And what I look at now is that I think I was trusted and trusted them. I think that's very, very difficult to find in any particular discipline. I wouldn't discount being involved in football if someone asked me, but I'm not going to seek any employment because I don't want to have that. Don't want to be tied down to doing something. It becomes all consuming. I mean, I loved doing what I was doing and I never had any days off. Mm. But my days off were actually going to do what I was doing because it was such a pleasure to be involved in. I'm not sure I'd be willing to commit to that, certainly for some of the fools who are involved in professional football now.
Can I ask you one final question, which has always absolutely fascinated me and perhaps quite ironic when we're talking about the sort of technological impact on football? Were you the first Manchester United player to send a text?
Yeah.
That's true, is it?
Yeah.
How come? Were you the first one to get a phone or what was the...
No. I'll tell you a funny story about the phone as well, you know, with it. But what happened was we had mobile phones, not the... Dom Jolly, not them. Just about the same size they are now. The same size they are now, right? And I was on the bus going to an away game, and the phone vibrated, and I look at this little tiny screen, and I'm looking, I'm going, what's that? And it's a message from my brother. Message from my brother, and I'm like, "Has he done that?" She said, "Nah, something like hello, bro, what are you up to?" Someone, I'm like, "Has he done that? That's amazing." And I phoned him. I said, "Have you done that?" And he told me how to do it. So I'm spent. The I'm messaging the rest of the stupid messages, you know. Yeah, life shit, then you'll die, sort of stuff, you know. They're like, "Where's this coming from?" You know. I got a hairdryer because of technology as well. I was sitting on the bus and my phone rang, and the whoever it was came up on the screen. It might be my brother again. It came up, my brother, and Fergie was sitting across from me playing cards, and he must, you know, how do you do that? I goes, well, anybody can do it. You just have to program the number at the time. You have to program the name next to the number. You do that for me. I went, man, you can imagine what his phone's like, you know. 3 hours, I'm doing the whole journey from Manchester to London. 3.5 hours, I'm going, right, who's this? And he's telling me who this is. You want to call him this name or that name and whatever. I've gone through the whole phone list. And he never won at cards. So he was usually quite grumpy. So he, at the end of the night, and he grabs the phone, he's that, right, and storms away at the front of the bus. So that would have been on Friday. Saturday, we'd play the game and we'd travel home. And he'd go home Saturday night. And he often would just, whether he was in good mood or bad mood, he'd just drive into his driveway at the time. And he lived in a little cul-de-sac, there had no real security. And he used to drive into his drive, get out of his car, slam it, go into the house and have his cup of tea, his supper or whatever. And he had 3 mobile phones stolen from his car on a Saturday night, not the same one, but 3 different occasions where he'd left the door. Anyway, 3 mobile phones. So on the Monday, he used to come over a wee bit later to Littleton Road, and you could tell when he was in a bad mood, and he's coming over, and you could see the steam coming out of his ears, he's purple. And he comes marching straight up to me, right into the middle of the... There's something ongoing. We're doing something. They could slice him straight into the middle of it. You fucking clever bastard. Yeah, you're fucking clever, don't you? And I'm like, and at this point, you're like, that, what have I been doing? You know, you're trying to work back. What was that? Was I out yesterday? Was I out late yesterday? Did I do some Saturday night? What did I do in the game on Saturday? Did I go out last Thursday when I wasn't supposed to be out? You know, it's just something you're like, what have I done? You know, and he's fucking poking me in the chest. You're fucking clever, don't you? Fucking clever. Oh, wow. You're fucking technology. And anyway, just mystified. And what had happened was that the phone that I had sorted out all the names next to the numbers had been stolen out of his car. And on Sunday afternoon, the home phone went, his phone went at home, and Kathy answered the phone. And there's a Kathy, hello. And the other voice at the other side goes, is that Kathy? And she went, yes, it is. And the voice at the other side went, you're a fucking bitch. And put the phone down, right? Well, he got it on his ear all day after that. She'd been calling him all day long, give him a hard time. You and those phones, you and this. He did it all day. And because he'd got it all day on Sunday, I got it on Monday. I got it on Monday. I did him a favour. Hairdryer. Technology. There you go. So.
McClare's mailbag. McClare's mailbag. McClare's mailbag.
You've asked, so Brian's going to answer. Matthew, get the question out, please.
Yep, this is a question from our old friend Dave McLaughlin, Cumbrian Dave, as you know him, Brian. And he writes, Sir Alex Ferguson recently said he couldn't split you, Ronnie Johnson and Ji-Sung Park as his most underrated players. Who was the most underrated player you ever played with?
The most underrated player I ever played with, I would say at Celtic, it would be a centre-half called Tom McAdam. At Manchester United, I would say Arthur Alveston.
Really? Mm-hmm. Any other reasons?
I think they're the kind of player that you would that give you minimum 7 out of 10 every game. Not fussy, came in, did the work that was expected of them during the day, and always performed very well. Another one I would put into that back, I think, in the same position as Arthur was Dennis Irwin. I mean, 12 years of top quality performances in Manchester United and the Republic, and also went on to perform very well for Wolves, the team that he supported as a kid.
Just thinking, Henry, you've obviously followed United during the time Brian was there. I mean, anyone stand out? Somebody asked you that question. Is anyone that you would choose particularly?
I would go subsequently. I would mention Michael Carrick, and I know, you know, he took a penalty in the Champions League final. He's delivered. Five titles. I mean, he was just, you know, a formidable player. But I still think, from an England perspective, and as we're in the middle of a tournament, I think if Michael Carrick had been properly appreciated by England, I think England would have, you just saw some of his performances like sort of 2006 when he came in at midfield, and he just blended all that playing talent England had around, and I just think that not underrated by Manchester United, but I think underrated by England, and I just think that intelligence, that appreciation of not giving away the ball, playing to the passing, I just think. Yeah, from an England perspective, I would say Carrick. I would also say England didn't use Paul Scholes. I can remember watching a training session, which I probably wasn't supposed to be watching, when Sven used him tucked in on the left in training.
Did Bielsa send you to that?
Yeah, with the goggles. Yeah, he was. But and, you know, and then Scholes sort of on the flight back from 2004. Here's a quick Lisbon Lions story for you. You know where England trained in 2004? They trained at the Estadio Nacional in Lisbon. And being sort of English and arrogant, we didn't realise the sort of historical significance of where England were training until a Scotland fan, probably in his late 50s, just walked straight onto it, walked past FA security, walked past all the England players who were doing their sort of rondos and boxes. Sven looked at him slightly bemused. He walked to the centre circle, knelt down, kissed the centre circle, and then walked off. And a couple of us caught up with him and said, what was all that about? He said, well, Lisbon Lions, what are England doing here? And I just, you know, again, coming back to the respect for Scotland. But it was brilliant because it was a huge UEFA England training session, security, cameras, media. And I think he was just on holiday nearby and he told his family, listen, I've got to go and pay homage to where the Lisbon Lions had their greatest moment, obviously. And I would say, I mean, from an England perspective, England didn't use Scholes properly and they certainly didn't use Carrick properly.
Okay, that's time for us to wrap up again. Henry, thanks for taking the time out of your busy schedule covering the Euros. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on.
Pleasure.
And of course, it's always a pleasure being in the company of Brian and Matthew too. Thanks, chaps.
Thank you very
much. Always a pleasure. Thank you, Henry.
Thanks to you for listening. We really appreciate you taking the time to do so. You'll continue to find us on all the major podcast platforms. And we're now on YouTube too, where we're sharing these episodes and various video clips from our recordings. So look out for Life with Brian, the Brian McClare podcast on YouTube, as well as Apple, Spotify and all the rest. Obviously, we want you to subscribe so you get notified when a new episode comes out. We are at Brian McClair Pod on Twitter for the mailbag questions, general chit chat, and if you fancy offering us a few pints. So we'll see you soon. Cheers.
Life with Brian, talking films or music. Life with Brian, talking TV and food. Life with Brian, talking trivia and exercise. Life with Brian is different every episode. Life with Brian, talking politics and football. Life with Brian is different every episode. Life with Brian. Life with Brian.
Podcast Network. Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.